So let's get started here. Today we are going to start a new topic, which is synchronization. Okay? Before I do that, I had a couple of announcements. The next homework should be out hopefully today. Okay? And as soon as I am done with synchronization, sometime next week, the next lab is going to be out. Okay, that's the first real lab. As I have been saying, you need to know something about threads and synchronization. By middle of next week, we would have actually covered both of those topics. Okay, so it's time to do the first lab assignment. Okay, so that's going to be out. It will be due in a couple of weeks from the handout date. Approximately 2 weeks. I haven't figured that out. The other thing to keep in mind is there are two midterms that are part of the course. So I need to schedule dates for the midterms. Typically the exams are evening exams, okay, as a standard for the course. So the exam is not going to be held in class. It will be held in the evening around 6 through 7:30. I am going to decide on the dates and let you know. The exam is still a few weeks away, the first one. Okay, but it's because we have to have one in October and one in November. The final will be in December. Okay, so we'll have one hopefully towards the end of October, one before Thanksgiving, and there will be one more final. Okay? So keep that in mind. I will announce the dates when the time comes. But for now, for this week, just keep an eye out for the homework. Okay, last time the homework came out and most people didn't know it had gotten, it was put out. Okay, so I will send an email this time just to be sure. But you should keep track of what's happening on the course schedule. Okay. Has anyone downloaded the audio? No, you have? Does it work?
Yeah, some of them are like louder than others.
Some are louder than others?
Yeah, some are like really loud and some are like fine.
Okay, I need to figure out. Maybe I'm not wearing the mic. I wear the mic properly. I will check that. I don't know why that is happening. Okay, and there are course notes also that we are putting up. Is there a book on reserve now? Did you make that request? I asked you to.
I made the request.
Okay, so we have made a request to put some stuff on reserve for you. Hopefully, why don't you check and let the class know. Okay, so, alright, so let's talk about synchronization. Before I do that, I did promise last time that I would revisit this multi-level feedback queue example. Okay, so I said we actually did one example where all jobs were compute intensive. And this example actually asked you to figure out what happens to three jobs where two are CPU bound and one is IO bound. Okay, don't know if any of you have even looked at this. I presume that most of you did not, but let me go back and explain to you what's going to happen here, and then we'll start synchronization. Okay, so there are three jobs there. Okay. One with length 30, one with length 20, and one with length 10. The one with length 10 actually does I/O for 1 second after every 1 second of computation. Okay? So what's going to happen here is the job with 30 is going to run for one time slice, which is 1 second, and then it will use its time slice, it will drop down. The job with 20 runs next, it will use its time slice, it will go down one level. And then the job with length 10 will run. Okay, and it will basically run for a second. And just before this time slice expires, it will issue an IO request. Okay? So it will basically go back to the wait queue. It will not be in this queue. Okay? But because it did not use its time slice, when its IO is done, it will rejoin this queue. Okay? Because if you don't use your time slice, you are bumped one level up. If you are already at the highest level queue, you stay there. Okay? And if you use your time slice, you go one level down. So what happens in this example is that the job with length 10 stays here and the other two jobs fall to the lowest queue, which is the second one here. Okay? So now because this queue is empty, because that job is still doing IO, you will run again the job with length 30, okay, for 2 seconds. Okay? And then it will basically use its time slice, it will go to the end of the queue. Once this job is done, the first job, the one that was doing IO, would have finished its I/O. It does 1 second of I/O, two more seconds have elapsed. So that job has rejoined this queue. Because this is a higher priority queue, it gets picked to run. Okay, so you will run that job again for a second, it will go back to doing I/O. Okay, and then you will basically pick the job with length 20 again and run. So essentially what happens is, you run the job with length 30, then you run the job with 20, and you run the job with length 10. Okay, then this does I/O. Okay, that required that basically says you will run the job with length 30 again. Okay, and then this comes back to doing I/O. So you again run this one, does I/O. Then you basically, since you're round robin between doing round robin between these two jobs, you will run 20. Then this one comes back, run it, it does I/O, you do 30, and so on. Okay, that's the order in which you will run. The jobs with length 30 and 20 are always, once they arrive here, they stay here. The other job actually stays in this queue. Okay, that's what is shown here. That's the solution. So you'll see initially all three jobs are here, 1, 2, and 3. Okay, and then 1 and 2, after this point, basically just go to this queue and keep executing. But between any two jobs, this job becomes active again, so you run. So you basically do 1, 3, 2, 3, 1, 3, 2, 3, and so on. Okay, that's how you'll alternate between them. Okay? So it's important that you understand how MLFQ works. If there are questions, ask. Yes.
So in the description, you said the initial time frame is 1 second.
Yes.
So that then,
what's the question? So the time slice here is 1 second, the time slice here is 2 seconds. Okay? I'm not sure what the question is. What does it say? Does it say something else? Initial slice, time slice, 2 seconds. Okay, that is a typo. It doesn't matter.
Well, doesn't it matter? Because it takes 1 second of I/O every other second, and the initial time slice is 1 second, then the I/O will never matter.
No, I/O will always matter, because if, regardless of the time slice, that's actually a typo, because the time slice is specified here. It should have been this time slice is 1 second and this one is 2 seconds. I will fix that. But it doesn't matter which of the two examples you use to do the solution. Even if you use the 2 second time slice, what would have happened is the job with length 10, it would run, it would be given a 2 second time slice. It will only run for the first second of that time slice. It will go back to doing I/O. Its time slice will end at that point. Yes, because if you relinquish the CPU, if you issue an I/O request, the time slice ends immediately. You will go back to the wait queue.
But you just said it would run for 2 seconds. But it's if the initial time slice is only 1 second, then it will never run for more than the
No, so I... Let me explain what this job is supposed to. So the 10 second job has 1 second of I/O every other second. So what that means is it runs for 1 second of CPU, it does I/O, okay, it does 1 second of I/O, then it becomes ready to run again. Okay, when it's again put on the CPU, it will run for 1 second and then it will do an I/O at the end of that second. Okay, and then that I/O takes another second. Okay, is that clear?
Right, but if the time... So is this just the initial time slice is 1 second, or is this...
This is just saying, if that is the case, if that was 2 seconds, it would mean this one was 2 seconds and this one would be 4 seconds.
Okay, so...
That's all it was saying. I think that was a typo there. Should have said that this is 1 second initial, meaning the one at the top one, and this one is 2 seconds. Yes.
Doesn't the kernel know that it's doing I/O because it... the job finishes before its time slice?
Yes, it does.
So if that runs for 1 second, wouldn't it not know that it's doing I/O?
What would not know? The kernel?
The kernel wouldn't know that job is doing I/O because it would take up 1 second.
No, you do 1 second of computation, then you do 1 second of I/O. Think of this program very simply as, let's say, you have a while loop, you have a for loop, you do this for loop for some number of time and you do a print and then you do this forever. So this is 1 second of computation, this is 1 second of I/O. And you go back to doing 1 second of computation, you do 1 second of I/O. Okay, that's essentially what that job is doing. Okay, so there is some confusion that probably cause some thing, but does actually the behavior wouldn't have changed regardless of the length of the time slip. Completion times may have differed. Any other questions about what this algorithm does? Yes.
I have a question about the notation.
Yes.
What are the
numbers? Okay. So at the end of the day, this is the table you need to fill up. Okay. This is just showing you how the jaws behave. Okay. Now that said, if you want, then the notation is as follows. Okay. So it is basically job name. Okay. That's basically this 1, 2, or 3 are the job numbers. Job 1, job 2, job 3. So what is on the superscript is CPU time received. Okay, what the subscript is current system time. Okay, this is just allowing you to keep track how much CPU this job has received in the superscript and what's the current time. Okay, so what this says is this job has received thus far 1 second of CPU time, and the current time in the system is 3 seconds have elapsed. Okay. If you look here, it will say job 2 has thus far received 11 seconds of CPU time, and the current time in the system is 26. That's all it is saying. Okay. You can use your own notations, but so long as you explain what the notation is, that's fine. It's just allowing you to just track what is happening in the system. Which job is in which queue, how much CPU time it has received, what is the current time. Other questions here before I move on? Okay. So we can come back to it if there are questions. Let me just start the next topic, which is synchronization. Okay. So we will illustrate the problem of synchronization using a real world example. Okay. And then we'll try to come up with solutions to solve this problem. Okay. So this problem is referred to as problem of having too much milk. So I assume that you are staying in a dorm with someone else, okay, and then you need to make sure that there is milk in your refrigerator. Okay, and so here is a scenario. Okay, so you say you arrive at home, okay, at some point this is time. You look in the fridge, okay, and you say there is no milk. So you say let me go to the grocery store to buy milk. So you leave to go buy milk. Okay, once you are left, your roommate arrives. Okay, that's 3:15. Roommate looks in the fridge, says there is no milk. Okay. Roommate decides saying that they want to go get milk. So they leave for the grocery store. Okay, while they are looking, you actually arrived at the grocery store, you buy milk, you come home, you put milk in the fridge. Okay. And then while you are doing this, your roommate has actually gone to buy milk, they buy milk, they come home, put milk, and now you have too much milk. Okay, because you have 2 gallons of milk rather than one. Okay. So the problem is basically how do you coordinate? Okay, how do two entities, in this case you and your roommate, coordinate to ensure that you have sufficient milk in the refrigerator? Neither too much nor too little. Okay? So we will now try to come up with solutions for this problem. Okay, is that clear what the problem is here? Okay, so we will start with some terminology and then we will go through a sequence of solutions to understand what the synchronization problem is and what can go wrong and how to get it right. Okay, but here is some terminology that we will use. Okay, first, synchronization. It's the use of atomic operation to ensure cooperation between threads. Okay, in this case, we assume that the entities eventually are threads. Threads are cooperating to do certain tasks. Okay, and when you use synchronization, you use what are called atomic operations. Atomic essentially says all or nothing. Okay? Either everything happens or nothing happens. This is referred to as atomicity. Meaning you take a sequence of statements, either all of them executes or none of them executes. You shouldn't have a scenario where half of those statements execute and the other half fail to execute. Okay? This is referred to as atomicity. We'll come back and look at why we need atomicity. Okay? Mutual exclusion is the property that says that only one thread can be doing a certain activity at any time. And while it is doing that activity, it explicitly blocks or prevents any other thread from doing that activity. Okay, this is called mutual exclusion, okay, mutually exclusive access. Okay, only one thread does a particular activity, and not only that, it excludes any other thread from doing that activity at the same time. Those threads can do that activity at some other time, but only one thread at a time can do that activity. Okay? Critical section is a piece of code that only one thread can execute. Okay? So if you have mutual exclusion, then the code that you're executing to do that activity is referred to as a mutual critical section rather. Okay? Three important things. What is synchronization? And synchronization essentially is implemented using mutual exclusion. The code that is involved in mutual exclusion is called critical section. Okay? The first mechanism we will study to do synchronization is called a lock. Okay, so we will study what locks are in just a moment. It's essentially a mechanism that prevents some other thread from doing something. We will come back to locks. Okay, don't worry about this, how locks are used. We will come back to that. Okay, let's go back to the too much milk problem. Here is a solution. Those are the properties we want to ensure. Okay, the property is only one person buys milk at any given time. Okay, and that somebody buys milk. A trivial solution to the too much milk problem is you come, you say there is no milk, say forget it, let my roommate buy. Your roommate comes, says there is no milk, I say forget it, let the other person buy. So nobody does anything. That's a correct solution because you will never have too much milk. Okay, but you will have no milk as well. Okay, so you want to ensure both properties. Only one person buys milk and then somebody buys milk. So you shouldn't have no milk, neither should you have too much. Okay. We will assume for the purpose of this code that loads and store instructions, loads and store assembly instructions are atomic, which means that when you update the value of a variable which is a store, or you look up the value of a variable which is a load, that those two instructions are atomic. Okay, why this is necessary you may not appreciate, but just assume that. We will come back to that in just a second. Okay. Here is another solution. Okay, what does this solution do? Okay, so here is a piece of code that you can use to solve the too much milk problem. So if no milk and there is no note, okay, so you leave a note, you buy milk and then you remove note. So here is a case where you say, I will look in the refrigerator, if there is no milk, I am going to leave a note saying I have gone to buy milk. Okay, so you are always supposed to check whether there is a note on that refrigerator and whether your refrigerator has milk. Okay, if there is no note and there is no milk, then you assume that the other person is not buying milk and so it's your turn to buy milk. So that's the essential idea. So it says if no milk and no note, you leave a note, you go buy milk, and then you remove that note. Okay? And the other person, in this case the thread, but it could be a roommate, essentially follows the same strategy. Okay, is that clear what the solution is? Okay, yes, question.
Won't this fail if the CPU gets ripped away right after the if statement?
Yes. So the question is, does this work? And there's at least one suggestion which says it will not work in a certain scenario. So to understand why it will not work, we will assume that basically when these two threads are running, anything can happen in terms of CPU scheduling. Okay? In particular, your time slice, okay, assume that you have time slices and thread one is running, your time slice can end at any point, at which point you will suspend the execution of one thread and you might resume the execution of another thread. Okay? So you want correctness to be ensured regardless of how the CPU scheduler schedules this thread. It shouldn't be the case that only if these threads are scheduled in this way will the program work, but if it's scheduled in some other way, it doesn't work. Okay? So you don't want the correctness to depend on how the scheduler works. You want the correctness to be true regardless. Okay? So the suggestion that was made here was the following. Okay? Thread A is executing, let's say. So there's only one CPU, so thread B is not doing anything at this point. Thread A basically checks this if clause. It says, is there a milk? Like, there's no milk. Is there a note? There is no note. Okay, and then it enters the if statement. Okay? So let's assume that as soon as it has entered the if statement, its time slice has expired. Okay? As soon as its time slice expires, the CPU scheduler suspends the execution of this thread. So it's basically here now. It hasn't executed the next statement. It's just entered the if. So you suspend the execution of this thread. Okay, and then you pick another thread. Let's say you pick thread B. Okay, thread B executes. It will again check the if statement. Okay, it will say, is there any milk? There's still no milk. Is there a note? There still isn't a note. Okay, so thread B will also enter the if statement. Okay, now if both threads have entered the if statement, you can see what happened. Both of them basically will go and buy milk. So let's say after you enter the if statement, again the time slice expires. Okay, so you switch back to A. Okay, so A continues execution from where it left off. So it will leave a note, it will buy milk, it will remove the note, and let's say the time slice expires after you removed the note. Okay, then you will go back to B. B will at this point leave a note, go buy milk, and then remove a note. Now you have too much milk. Okay. So just checking didn't help. Okay, is that clear? So in real life, this is the equivalent of you basically looked for a note. Okay, looked for milk, and then you didn't immediately leave a note. You went and did something. Okay, your roommate came and checked the refrigerator, looked for a note, didn't immediately leave a note, went off and did something, and then each of you come back and don't check again. You leave a note, then you go buy milk, take the note off, then your roommate comes, he leaves, or he or she leaves a note, buys milk, then you're stuck. You have too much milk. Any questions on this? Okay, so clearly this solution does not work, because there is at least one order in which the CPU scheduler can schedule them, which causes the solution to be produce an incorrect result. Okay, so they clearly need to coordinate, but this method of coordination doesn't work. Any questions? Any ideas on what we can do? Can put a padlock on the fridge. Okay. Yes, you have something to say.
Can you, to solve this, can we make leaving the note and checking for a note an atomic operation? You can't leave a note unless you just right now checked if there was a note first?
Yes, so we could make things an atomic operation, but we don't know what atomic operations are yet. So we are just trying to see if there are other solutions that will work that only depend, okay, on the fact that loads and stores are known to be atomic, meaning that this is actually a load. You're checking the value of this variable. You're checking, those are loads. Leave a note is a store. You're updating the value of a variable. You just say note is something. Okay? Those are known to be atomic. Beyond that, we don't know anything. We don't know that locks exist as yet. Okay? So can we do it with just this much? Here is another solution. Okay? This one, you basically leave a note first and then you check the refrigerator. Okay? And also you leave name notes. Okay? So you basically say, leave a note saying, I am A, I am going to go buy milk. And then you check, did B leave a note? Okay? If there is no note from B, then you check, is there any milk? If there is no note from B, there is no milk, you go buy milk. Okay? If any of these two clauses fail, then you basically just go and remove the note saying, either there is milk in the refrigerator or B has gone to buy milk. Okay? So you don't need to do anything. B does the same thing. B leaves the note. B checks, did A leave a note? If not, is there any milk? If not, you go buy milk. Okay. So now this is the second solution. Trying to be smart. Leave a note first, then check. Does it work? No. Why does it not work?
A leaves a note and then it suspends A and puts up on B. Leave a note and then
check, see that A left a note. Right. Not by note. And then, if then B, it goes back to A. A sees that B left a note. A won't go by note. A will take us to the note. Okay. So here is the scenario that is being mentioned. So we say A leaves a note first. Okay. And then time slice expires. Okay. So A is suspended. All it has done thus far is leave a note, and it was going to check whether B had left a note. Okay, so then you go to B. Okay, B leaves a note. And let's say B gets suspended. Okay, so then you go back to A, and A checks whether B has left a note. At this point, there is a note from B, right? Because B has just left that note. So A assumes that it's now B's job to buy milk. So it will basically just escape from the if clause. Remove the note. Okay, maybe it doesn't remove the note yet. Let's say it just comes out of the if and it gets suspended again. Okay, the note is still there. All it has checked is B has left a note. Yes, so you don't do anything. You're just here. Okay, A resumes and A is now going to check. There is still a note from B is going to check rather. There is still a note from A. Okay, so it will assume that the other one is going to buy milk and it will come out here. Okay. Okay, then both will remove a load and then both will retry. Okay, so in real world, this is the equivalent of you left a note, your roommate left a note, each assumes, sees the other person's note and assumes that the other person buys milk and doesn't go to the grocery store. You just take off your note. Okay? So this basically fails the second property, that someone buys milk. Okay, it doesn't leave you with too much milk. Each thread in this case assumes that the other thread is going to do the work and doesn't do anything. Okay, both thread think the other one does work, neither accomplishes anything. So you have basically no milk. Okay, so this doesn't, the previous one you had too much milk, this one you have too little. Okay, yes.
Wouldn't it be better to leave a note only if there isn't already a note classified?
Yes, there's another solution saying why not check first and then leave a note. We'll come back to that. That's another solution coming down the road. Okay, so this one fails the other test. Okay, so it basically fails that second property saying someone buys milk. This one fails the first one saying only one person buys milk. Okay, so two solutions, neither of them work. Okay, here is a yet another solution. Okay, so here, thread A, so this is not symmetric. The code for A and B are not the same. In one case, there is actually, you'll see that there is more code here than there. Okay, the B's code is the same as the previous one. Okay, that's basically what was there before, which is you leave a note, you check whether A left a note, check whether there is milk, you buy milk and that's it. Okay, so B has not changed the code, A's code is different. Okay, A in this case leaves a note and there is a while loop which says while there is a note from B, just sit there looping. Okay, don't do anything, just sit and loop. Okay? And then it says when you come out of that while loop, there is no more note from B. At that point you check whether there is milk, you buy milk, okay, and then you take the note. Okay? So in the real world, think of it that either you or your roommate is more paranoid and doesn't trust the other person. Okay? So you see the note, you say I am going to wait here until the person comes, my roommate comes and takes the note off, and then I am going to check whether he or she actually bought milk, because I don't trust her that just by him or her that leaving a note will actually result in milk. Okay? That's that while loop. They're just waiting, saying there's a note, let me wait. Okay, once the note goes off, then you check, did that thread actually do the job or not. Okay, so that's essentially that solution. This is the same as before. Okay, it was a simple thing, you leave a note, you check for the other note, if not, you go buy milk and come back. Okay, is this clear? The question is, does it work? Does it meet those two properties or not? Is there some weird scheduling thing that will actually make it not work? Any guesses? It's hard to reason. Let me make it clear. What do you think? What might go wrong if you stood at the fridge waiting for the note to go off and then you checked? Bless you. So does anybody believe it will not work? Is it too suspiciously strange? Yes, you don't think it will work. Okay. So what you said is you leave a note A, okay, and then you go to B. Okay, yes.
If B leaves a note and then sees that A didn't leave a note,
yep,
inside that A.
Yep.
And then if it the time says expired, it goes to A. A will leave a note and then wait for B to finish.
Yes. And B will finish because B is here. B will buy milk. Then when A comes out of that while loop, it will check and there is milk, so it won't do anything. Okay, so it turns out that this is actually a correct solution. Okay? There's a long-winded reasoning here, which says what can happen at any point, okay? Regardless of whether there is a note, there is no note. I'm not going to go into the details of this. Okay? All I want you to understand is the reasoning is quite complex, because it's very, you have to look at all possible things that could happen. Did A leave node? When did this thread switch from that thread to the other? And convince yourself that regardless of what happens, in what order the threads execute, whenever, when this time slice expires, you will actually end up with milk and somebody will buy milk. Okay? In real life, if one person is more paranoid and keeps checking, you will actually end up with milk. Okay? That's basically the simple way to think about it. Okay? But the problem is, A, writing this code is hard. Okay, if you are asked to solve this problem, it's very unlikely you will actually write the code this way. It's more likely that you would have done one of these other two things. Okay? Even worse, convincing yourself that the solution works is even harder. A, it's not symmetric solution. Suppose there are three roommates, not two. How would the code differ? How many should actually be the more paranoid threads and how many should be the non-paranoid ones? Can you then reason that the code will work or not work? Okay? So it makes the reasoning much harder. Writing the code is also hard. Okay, so what you want is the solution is work. First, it's too complex. Okay, I don't sort of understand it if you just show it to me. Okay, it's asymmetric. Okay, you're doing the same task, but the code, the first two solutions were the same, or both threads were executing the exact same code. In this case, at least one thread, maybe if there are n, some number of threads will do different things. Okay, you don't want that. That's too complicated. The last problem is that A is doing what is called busy waiting. Okay? It's essentially sitting in a loop here, okay? Not doing anything. It's just waiting for something. So it's, but it is computing, because it's just checking this condition over and over again in the while loop. So the CPU is busy, not really accomplishing anything. Okay? So that's called busy wait. You are busy doing a wait, because you are keeping the CPU busy while waiting for something. Yes, question.
Would it just execute that one piece of code, like just check if there's a note,
it doesn't matter. In this case, the time slice can expire while you're in the while loop. When your new time slice starts, you're still in the while loop. So you keep checking. Until that condition becomes false, you'll sit in this while loop.
But the question was, like, if you add like a time slice, would the whole time slice just be spent just checking that?
Yes, essentially. Yes.
So yeah, okay.
Because that's what I'm saying. You're wasting CPU cycles. Depends on how long this thing takes. Thread B, you'll spend your entire time slice, maybe lots, many subsequent time slices, just executing this while loop. Okay? And not doing anything useful. You're just, yes.
Realistically, though, wouldn't reading, checking if there was node B, be an IO? So wouldn't use the whole.
Okay. Question is this IO? This is not IO. This is just checking the value of a variable.
Memory?
No, that's, IO means you write to disk. Just saying if I or node B equal to true is just checking the value of a variable. That's not IO. You just check the value of a register. I mean, that's an assembly instruction, really. So that's not IO. So you'll just keep doing that computing. Okay, there's no IO in this code at all. These are all computations. Okay, so this is not good either. Okay, A is consuming CPU resources without doing any useful work. There are three problems. Okay? The first one is the real problem. It's too complex. You don't understand it, which means you won't write it. If somebody else writes it, you can't debug it. Okay, so that's something we want to get rid of. Okay, so that basically motivates the need for synchronization primitives. Okay, you can write. So what this is illustrating is you can write code that will work without any special support from your operating system to do anything more, but that code will become very complex because you are doing synchronization and you want the code to work regardless of the order of CPU scheduling and so on. So the question is, can we define some higher level primitives that allow us to do this coordination? But it's very easy to write code, it's very easy to reason that the code is correct. Okay, so relying on these loads and stores is not a good idea. Okay, that's what we have done so far. Assume that loads and stores are atomic, and that basically means that the code is more complex. So can we come up with primitives that allow blocks of instructions to be atomic, not just load and store instructions? Okay? So what we will do is we'll actually study three such primitives. Okay, today I'm going to introduce locks, and then next class we'll do semaphores and monitors. Okay? They are all equivalent in terms of power. Okay? They can all allow you to write code where you can synchronize with threads and do certain things. Okay. So in terms of overall power, they are all equivalent. In terms of what level of abstraction they provide, they are somewhat different. Monitors provide you slightly higher level abstraction, right, than logs and semaphore. So it's somewhat easier, as you will see, to write code using monitors than logs and semaphores. Right? Just as an aside, this is something we'll come to, Java supports monitors out of the box. Okay? You can just use one single keyword, and then you basically can turn an entire class or an object into a monitor. When you do semaphores and logs, you have to do a little more work in terms of writing code, okay, as you will see. Okay, but today, you only need to worry about logs, not semaphores and monitors. Okay, so here is the notion of a log. Once you understand what logs are, we will study how you implement logs. What the real objective here is, how should the kernel implement this notion of a log. This is a course on OS, not a course on synchronization. Okay, so here, so what do logs do? Logs provide mutually exclusive access, okay, to any shared data or a shared piece of code. Okay. And the log abstraction has two methods. There is an acquire of log and there is a release of a log. Okay. So whenever you want to execute any code that you want to be atomic, you protect it with a log. Okay. At the beginning of the code, you have to acquire the log. Okay. And when you are done executing that small piece of code, you release the log. What log guarantees is once you have acquired it, okay, no one else will be able to acquire that log until you release it. Okay? Logs essentially guarantee that only one thread can hold the log at any given time. It is like if you have a token and you basically pass this token and there is only one token in the room, only one person can hold that token. And while that person is holding a token, no one else can hold the token. So the essential idea is you have to first acquire a log, and log by definition guarantees that only one thread can hold it. Okay? And that actually guarantees you mutual exclusion. Okay, so the rules for writing code with logs are always acquire the log before entering a critical section, before accessing shared data, and release the log after you finish. Okay, the lock value is initially free, which means no one holds the lock. Okay, here is the too much milk problem using locks. Okay, so the code we want to execute is very simple. It says for check if there is milk. If there is no milk, go buy milk. Okay, that's all we want to really do. That's all the code you write. And all you will do is you will protect this code with a lock acquire at the beginning and lock release at the end. And that's it. That's all that you need to do to solve the too much milk problem. Okay? And this guarantees you that no matter how the CPU scheduler runs, okay, and executes this thread, this code will always be correct. That you will neither have too little milk nor will you have too much milk. Okay? If any of these threads actually get hold of the lock, okay, then once you have acquired the lock, the other thread, if it tries to acquire it, it will be blocked. It has to wait for the lock to be released by the thread that's holding it. So it cannot proceed. Okay, so if A runs first and A gets the lock, initially the lock is free. So the first call to lock acquire will succeed. A will get the lock and it will exit this acquire routine and it will go into the critical section and it will go buy milk. While it is doing this, if B runs, it tries to acquire the lock, it will be immediately blocked. It cannot proceed any further. Okay, so there is no question of it actually trying to buy milk while A is buying milk. Okay, so until A does release, just a second, until A does release, B will never get to run. B will be in the wait state. Okay, so as if it's doing I/O, it is not even, cannot even execute on the CPU anymore. It is just blocked from execution. After A does release, will this lock acquire actually succeed? Which means that A, it will come out of this lock acquire method and then it can enter the critical section. Yes, question. Okay, so if some thread does a lock acquire, any other thread that does a subsequent lock acquire will be blocked. By blocked, I mean it cannot execute. It will just sit there in that acquire method just waiting. Okay, it will not even exit this acquire method. Once that thread does release, then one of the many threads that are waiting to acquire lock, one of them will be chosen and the lock will be given to that thread. And in turn, everyone will be given a lock. Okay? That's how the lock class works or the lock method works. Okay? So basically what we want now is whenever you have any task that multiple threads do, you protect it with a critical section. If there's a variable, a shared variable that you want to access, you protect that with a lock. You do a lock acquire before you access it, you do a lock release after you are done. Okay, that's what we have done here. Okay, so the advantage of this is the solution is symmetric, okay, or asymmetry is gone. this solution works for arbitrary number of threads. You could have 100 or you could have 2. It's the same code and it always works the same way. Only one thread can be in the critical section, which is the code between the acquire and the release at any given time. So while you are, some thread is doing this, nobody can be executing this code. Okay, that's guaranteed by the law. So there isn't much else to do from sort of reasoning about correctness. Okay, yes, question.
This is sort of like the purpose of multi-threading, because you can't run two processes simultaneously.
Okay, so question is, does it not defeat the purpose of multi-threading, because when one thread is running, it's preventing other threads from doing something. You are right. But whenever you do synchronization, that's the way things go. That if one thread is doing something important and you don't want other threads to do it, they have to wait. Not all the code that you have in threads is our critical section. Only critical sections have to be protected by lock, and critical sections ensure serialized access, which means only one thread at a time can do it. Okay, but there will be a lot of other things that threads do in any multi-threaded application that are not critical sections. Those can execute in parallel. Okay. Critical sections will never execute in parallel. Only one thread can execute and others will be blocked. Okay, is that clear? Any other questions on threads, or not thread, locks? Okay, we haven't yet studied how to implement lock. Right now all I've done is introduce what a lock does. Okay, in your assignment you might use a lock or a semaphore. Okay, but you don't have to implement a semaphore. What we will study next is how do you actually implement this notion of a lock. Okay, so now we need to understand how to implement this lock itself. Okay, so here we need hardware support. Okay, if you go back to the very second lecture, I had mentioned that when we do synchronization, we'll come back to some of these things, which is that load stores are atomic, that you have the ability to disable interrupts, and there is something called a test and set instruction. Okay, so we'll look at two or three different implementations of locks that use these hardware features to implement locks. Okay, and that will show you how you can actually prevent other threads from acquiring a lock when one thread holds the lock. Okay. And semaphores and monitors will defer to next class. Okay, so we don't worry about that for now. Now the first method for implementing lock is by disabling interrupts. Okay, disabling interrupt basically says that if you actually disable the interrupts on a machine, the hardware interrupts on a machine, then when this code is running, nothing can interrupt it. Even the time slice getting expired is an interrupt, so you basically disable that interrupt. So your time slice may expire, but you get to run. Okay? So it's essentially guaranteeing that once you're disabled interrupts and you're running, nothing on the system, not even the kernel, can actually stop you from running until you're re-enabled interrupts. Okay? So essentially you're full control and nothing can stop you from executing until you're done. So the basic idea is critical sections are protected by disabling interrupts before the critical section and enabling interrupts, re-enabling interrupts at the end of the critical section. So essentially that's what we are going to end up doing. Yes, question.
If there was IO in a section like that, would that end time slice as well, or would it just...
Yeah, so your time slice can end, but in this case if you do IO, you will basically give up the CPU. Okay, so that is true. On the other hand, in the lock, what you can do whatever you want here. Okay? Once you held a lock, you can do I.O. here, you will still be holding the lock. Okay? You may have given up the CPU, but still it doesn't allow any other thread to run. It still be blocked. Okay? But when you are talking about disabling interrupts, you are right. To disable interrupts, you are running on the CPU. If you start doing I.O., you will give up the CPU. There's nothing you can do at that point. Okay? But locks don't have that problem. Okay, so here is basically your pseudo code for implementing the class method, the class object. Okay? So there are two, the pseudo code, okay? Not real Java code or not even C++ code for that matter. There are two methods you want to support, acquire and release. Acquires allows you to grab a lock, release allows you to release it. Okay? There is a value called the value of the lock. Initially the lock will be free. If any thread has acquired the lock will be busy. Or acquired at that point. And there is a queue here. Okay? The queue tracks which threads are presently blocked waiting to acquire the lock. Okay? Any number of threads may all call acquire all at the same time. The queue tracks all of those threads, saying there are 10 threads all waiting to grab the lock. And there's an order in which you appear in the queue is the order in which you call the lock function. Okay? Okay, this is the constructor for the class. The value is initially set to free, which is 0. Q is initially set to empty. Nobody is waiting to acquire the lock. Okay, this is essentially the acquire method. This is the release method. Okay, think of the acquire method as a system call. Okay, so this method is something that the kernel would execute on behalf of a thread. When you call lock acquire, you make a system call and this kernel will actually do all of this. So what does the OS do? First thing it does in the acquire is disable interrupts. Okay, at this point nothing can interrupt this piece of code. Okay, it will basically keep running. Okay, so what you do here is somebody is acquiring the lock. You basically check the value. Is the lock presently held by some other thread or is it free? Okay, if the lock is presently held, then you make this thread block. Okay, you basically add it to the queue and you put it to sleep, saying that the lock is held, there's nothing to do, please block, please wait. Okay, on the other hand, if the lock is free, okay, then you will basically just set the lock to busy, saying you have the lock now, the value of the lock has changed, and you just come out of the, you enable interrupts and you come out of the acquire. Okay, and then basically that thread that grabbed the lock here has now entered the critical section. Okay, so whoever basically grab the lock, doesn't wait. If somebody else holds the lock, you wait. Okay, is that clear? So what we are guaranteeing is between the disable and enable interrupts, okay, you cannot be context switched out. Okay, you will basically, this piece of code will run atomically. Okay, meaning that nothing can interrupt it, neither interrupts nor time slice being expiring will actually interrupt this piece of code. That's a critical section. Okay, is that clear? Okay, so this is the code for release. You basically do the opposite. You first, opposite meaning you always disable interrupts, and then some thread that held the lock is trying to release it. So what you do is you first check that queue. Okay, if some other thread is waiting to acquire that lock, you basically take that thread of the queue and wake it up, saying now you have the lock. If no thread is waiting to acquire the lock, then you set the lock value to be free and you just come out. Okay, so in the release you check, is there someone else waiting on the lock? If so, you give the lock to one of those threads. If no one is waiting for the lock, then the lock becomes free again for some thread in the future to acquire it. Okay, simple stuff. The only important thing is the interrupts here that are making this atomic. Okay, if these two statements weren't here, okay, then this code will not run correctly. Okay, the same kind of problem that happened in too much milk can happen, which is you will check the value and you might get context switch, then the release might run and bad things will happen. Multiple threads will enter the acquire method. Okay, because you are disabling interrupts, this thing cannot be interrupted. Okay, this will basically all run in one shot. Okay, so this is how you would actually go in and implement a lock method, by relying on the hardware feature that allows you to disable interrupts, prevent somebody from getting context switched. Okay, so we'll come back to wait queue in just a moment. Okay, but let me mention what the second way to implement locks is, which is atomic read, modify, write instructions. Okay, in this case, you will not use disabling and enabling interrupts. That's a bit hard to understand, but you will use another feature of the hardware, which are atomic instructions. Okay, so what does read, modify, write instructions do? That in a single assembly instruction, okay, we'll assume that always any assembly instruction itself is atomic. Okay, you don't get interrupted in the middle of an instruction. Okay, when you are whatever that assembly instruction is, you always get interrupted at the beginning or the end, not in the middle. So all instructions by definition are atomic. In this case, you do multiple things in a single atomic instruction. You read the value of a, so what read modify does is, read modify write instruction does, you read the value of a variable, you can modify it and you can write it back all in a single instruction. Okay, typically you would at least need three instructions to do this. You would read the value from memory, modify the value in a register, write that register back to memory. Okay, these three instructions have gotten collapsed into a single instruction. Okay, and the single instruction does three things all at once. Okay, read the value, modify that value, and write it back. Okay, so most hardware will support this. There is the most simple example of this is called a test and set instruction. There's an equivalent one on x86 Intel architectures called the exchange. in the Power PC Motorola architecture, you have something called compare and swap. They all essentially do the same thing. Okay, so for the purposes of our discussion, we'll ignore these two and only assume that that's the one that we want to sort of investigate further. So what test and set does is it basically reads the value of a variable. Okay, let's say variable I. You read the value and you write one back to the value. Okay, and you return the value that was read, of course. So you'll read the value, you'll modify it to 1. Okay, the value can be either 0 or 1. You'll read the value, you'll change it to 1 and you write it back in a single instruction. So you're testing the value and you're setting it to 1. You check it and set to 1. Okay, and the instruction actually returns the value. Is the instruction what it does clear? Otherwise, the next lock implementation will not be clear. Okay, so this is a much simpler implementation of locks. Doesn't do anything with interrupts. Only uses test and set. Okay, and I mean the acquire method is one statement. The release method is one statement. That's all we are doing here. Okay, so there are two methods: acquire and release, same as before. Okay, there's a value of the lock. There is no other, nothing else. Initially, the lock constructor sets the value to 0. Lock is initially free. Okay. So what do you do in lock acquire? You'll basically just run a while loop. Okay. You'll say while test and set the value of the lock, that this instruction returns 1, then set there and loop. Okay. What does test and set do? It will check the value of this variable called value. It will return that value and it will set it to 1. Okay. All in a single instruction. Okay, so let's assume initially the lock value is 0 and some thread calls lock acquire. Okay, what's going to happen to this while statement? Yes.
I'm pretty confused by your formatting. Are there two columns here?
Yes. Okay, so there are two columns. This is column 1 and this is column 2.
Okay, so that's not private release, that's private int value. Okay.
Yeah, okay. So that's basically assume that this code is actually here for the purposes of reading it.
Okay,
this is one column and this is the other column. Okay, this is not one statement. Okay, so let me repeat the question. Yeah, so initially the value of lock is 0. Okay, so then what does that test and set instruction do to value? What happens to the while loop? Okay, so what does test and set do again?
If the value is 0 or 1.
Test and set will read the value of the variable that you have specified. It will return that value. It will set the value to 1 and it will write it back. Okay, that's the definition of the test and set. That is what the instruction does. Okay, the hardware sort of supported instruction. Read the value and write 1 back to that variable. Okay, is that clear? So now let's go back to this and say, look at that code and say, how does this code behave? Initially value is 0, so what will happen to this while loop? What does test and set do? What's the value currently? It's 0, that's what you set it to. Okay, so what will test and set read? It reads the value, so the value is 0. Okay, so it is going to read 0. And it will return 0. It will return the value that is currently set. And then what will it do? It will change that value to 1. It will flip it to 1. And it will basically write 1 back to that variable. Okay, so the value of this variable has switched from 0 to 1. And you are basically returning the old value. Okay, so what will that do to the while loop? Zero equal to 1. Come on. Most people are asleep. No. Okay. So what does that do to the while loop? The test will fail, so you'll exit the while loop, which means that the acquire has succeeded. Okay? So now let's, so basically the first time, that's what you want, right? The lock is free. The first thread that acquires the lock will find the value to be 0. It will set the value to be 1, which means the lock is now in use, and it will exit the while loop and enter the critical section. That's what you want. Okay, now the next thread that comes in will do the same thing. It will check the value. Okay, now the value is 1. Test and set will return 1 and will write 1 back. So the value doesn't change at this point. Okay? So basically that will cause it to spin, because the value is 1. So you are waiting. So it says the value equals 1, sit and continue in the while loop. Wait for it to become 0. Okay? So any subsequent acquires after the first one will all cause those threads to sit and just spin here. It will just sit in the while loop waiting for the value to be 0, because this clause is now true. Because only the first thread gets to go into the critical section, all other threads are blocked. Okay? So when you do a release, the thread that had actually held the lock, eventually it will call release, it will switch the value back to 0. So subsequently, one of the thread that basically does a test and set, okay, the first one that does a test and set will again find the value to be 0, it will get to enter. All other threads will just sit and loop them. And so on and so forth. Once that is released, yet another thread will go in and so on. Okay? The thing that is important is the test and set is an atomic instruction. If that was not atomic, the way you would have actually done it is you would have said while something like, first you check the value and then you say not while. You would have done this. You would have checked the value and you would have set it. These are two separate instructions. Okay, test and set actually makes them one single instruction. So this is not atomic. Okay, so you could have checked the value and you could have context switched here. Another thread that is in acquire could have also checked the value and context switched, and both of them would have entered the if and set the value and entered the critical section. Okay? But because test and set is atomic, these two things are both happening in a single assembly instruction. So there is no context switching in the midst of an instruction. Okay, so you basically check and set in one go. That is why you get atomicity. Okay, so you are depending on this hardware feature. If that test and set instruction is not available, this is what your code would have looked like. And this has the same problem as what you had in too much will. You have an if statement, and then you do something inside the if. And multiple threads can enter the if, and then you are basically in trouble. And no synchronization. Okay, so this is locks with test and set. Okay, now this is a correct solution, but it's not a good one. Okay, and the reason for this is you have basically implemented your acquire function using a loop, a while loop that will just sit and spin. Okay, it's like, as I said, this is called busy wait. You are basically sitting and computing, sort of executing this test and set over and over again, waiting for that value to become 0. Okay, nothing useful is happening. It would have been better for you to have been put to sleep and woken up when the value actually turns to 0, rather than you sit and keep on checking, is the value 0, is the value. So you'll basically sit and spin. You'll basically waste CPU resources not doing anything useful. Okay? This is referred to as busy wait. Okay, busy waits are basically, they give you correct solution, but they also waste the CPU. They're better off actually not waiting, rather than just do computing while waiting. Okay? So what we want is a better solution. Okay, so now we'll have to look at how do you get rid of that busy wait. Okay, we are going to use test and set again, but this time we don't want this busy wait to occur. Yeah, so here is a new solution, a little more complicated, but it uses still the test and set property. Okay. So what we will do here, so this one does not get rid of busy wait. Okay, it's called a solution with minimal busy waiting. Okay. It's not going to sit and do busy wait for a long period of time, but there may be a short burst where some thread might do busy wait. That you may not be able to eliminate altogether. If you want to eliminate that, then you have to use interrupts. So you have to go back to the old solution that used interrupt. Okay. So basically what you do here is you basically have the release and the acquire, there's a statement here which is called the guard statement. Okay? A guard statement is like a sentry who stands outside the door of a room and only lets one person enter the room at any given time. So the guard is checking. Okay, if there is some thread that's already executing something, then you basically, or if there is somebody in the room, then the guard who's standing outside the room will say, you cannot enter, you have to wait. Okay, and then you keep checking, is there somebody in the room, and once the room becomes empty, then you get to go in next. Okay? That is essentially what this guard statement is doing. Guard is a variable, okay, whose value is initially zero. Okay? So the first thread that calls an acquire, okay, will basically just enter, because the guard will fail, the while clause will fail, guard will return a 0, it will be set to 1, so 0 is not equal to 1, so the while loop will exit and you will go into the acquire. Okay? If multiple threads all try to enter the acquire statement at this given time, they will all basically do busy wait here, because now the guard value is set to 1, because there is this thread as the first thread actually set it to 1. So all the other threads will just sit here and loop. They will not get to execute the rest of the statement, the rest of the method rather. Okay, so you are basically all stuck at the beginning waiting to execute the rest of the acquire. Okay, and the first thread will basically check the value is free. If it's not free, then you are basically put to sleep. And if some thread has actually held the lock, then you will be put on the queue and you will be put to sleep. Okay, so you are not going to busy wait until the lock is available. You will be busy waiting only to do this check and put to sleep immediately. So the length of your busy wait has gone down. Okay, you are not doing busy wait all the way until you get the lock. That was what happened in the previous solution. You only do a busy wait until you can check the value. And if somebody else holds the lock, then you are immediately put to sleep. Okay, and then you will be woken up at a later time. Okay. This is why this is a better implementation. Okay, because you are going to do some busy wait, but the length of the busy wait is different in this case. Okay, is that clear what I said? Should I explain any of this again? That's the same thing that's happening in release. You are going to have a guard here. So this guard is guaranteeing you that only one thread can either be in acquire or release at any given time, because it prevents everyone else from entering. They all get stuck at the guard. They are not allowed to proceed any further. Okay? That's essentially the same as ensuring that you are in a critical section. Okay, is that clear? So you have implemented release and acquire using test and set. Okay? You don't have as much busy waiting. You still have some. Okay, and that is not good, but at least you have reduced the length of the busy wait to a much smaller value. Okay, so any questions on this? Okay, the last thing I should mention is when you exit, you will reset the guard to let somebody else enter. Okay, this is where you set it, this is where you reset it. This code in the middle basically does check the value of the lock. If the lock is free, then you just grab the lock and set it to busy. If the lock is in use, then you are basically put on a queue of threads and asked to wait until the lock becomes available. In the release, you will check if the queue is not empty. The current thread is releasing the lock. If there is some other thread waiting, you give the lock to that thread. Okay, you wake it up. Okay? If there are no threads waiting, then the lock becomes free. Okay, and then you basically are done. So the code is somewhat similar to what happened with interrupts, but you are doing this with test and set. Okay? So this is the hardware feature you will rely on to implement synchronization. Okay, you can implement semaphores with test and set, you can implement monitors. Okay, something we'll look at next time. Okay, so let me go back to one more thing that I skipped here. Then we'll be done. Okay, so that was the issue of wait queues. Okay, so this code here with interrupts is somewhat subtle, okay? Because you are disabling interrupts and you are re-enabling it. You have to ensure that you first of all disable interrupts for only short periods of time. Disabling interrupts on a machine is not a good thing. Okay, it prevents other things from happening. If some packet arrives on a network, it has to wait. If the disk I/O finishes, it has to wait, because all of those interrupts get queued up. you can only queue up a certain number of interrupts. None of those interrupts get delivered because interrupts are currently masked. Okay? So disabling and enabling of interrupt. First of all, only the kernel can do this. Okay? Because if you allow a user program to do this, then the user program can essentially take over a machine. But nobody, once you are running on the CPU, you cannot be kicked off the CPU, no matter what happens to your timescale. Okay? So only the kernel does it, and whenever the kernel does it, you have to be very careful that you do it for a very short period and you re-enable it as soon as possible. Okay? So in this case, we will basically disable at the beginning and of the function, and you will enable it at the end. And this is a fairly short snippet of code, so you are not doing this for a long period of time. But here are some examples of what might happen. So let's say instead of implementing this code in the kernel, which is what's happened here, you implement this lock as a library, and you let actual threads enable and disable interrupt. Then you can actually have funny situations like this, where thread A is in acquire, it has disabled interrupts, and if lock is currently held by thread B, then it will go to sleep. Okay, and then it has not re-enabled the interrupts on the machine because it just went to sleep. That's the equivalent of you disabled interrupts and you put yourself to sleep. Okay, the interrupts still remain disabled. Okay, and then your machine is going to be in trouble because nobody has enabled it, re-enabled it. Okay, so you want to be very careful. Because this is done in the kernel doesn't put itself to sleep. The kernel is actually putting the thread to sleep, so this code is okay. Okay, but if you allowed user programs to do this, bad things can happen. You may have disable interrupts, go off to sleep, and the machine is basically not doing processing interrupts. Okay, that's not a good thing. So that's what this this example is showing, saying you have to be very careful. Okay, it shows that in some cases that works, but not in every possible case. Okay, so let me recap. We covered quite a bit of ground. Okay, so the first thing is we did this too much milk problem to illustrate why synchronization is necessary. Okay, by this time, even if you haven't understood how to implement a lock, what should be clear is that if you have any multi-threaded application that have where threads are cooperating to do certain tasks, you have to use synchronization. You can't let the threads do whatever they want. They will trample on each other. They will do things that are not intended. Okay? So whenever you have multi-threaded code, synchronization primitives go with it, whether it's locks or semaphores or monitors, which we haven't yet studied. Okay? That's number one. Number two is we looked at this first primitive, which is called a lock. Well, the usage of lock is very simple. There are only two methods in the lock class. There's an acquire method, there's a release method. If you want to protect any piece of code or any data structure for that matter, okay, you basically do a lock acquire before you run that piece of code or access that data structure, and you do a release at the end. Okay, so usage is very simple. It makes it very easy to understand what you're doing. Okay, you probably will use either locks or semaphores in your first lab. Okay, so it's good to understand what locks do. Okay? And then the last part of the course, the lecture, I showed you how you can actually implement locks in the kernel. Okay? So you might be using locks. You may have actually written lots of programs with monitors or locks. But since this is an OS course, what we are really interested is how is this functionality implemented? Okay? How do you even guarantee this kind of property? Okay? To do this, you need hardware features. Okay, so we saw two implementations. One that relies on interrupts. It's a very low-level implementation of locks. Typically something that is not used. But if you had no other option, meaning you didn't have something like test and set instruction, you could still implement locks by enabling or disabling and re-enabling interrupts. Okay, that guarantees you atomicity. Okay, the other slightly better way to implement it is if your hardware or your CPU implements this equivalent of a test and set instruction. Okay, test and set instruction is a special instruction that will check the value of a variable and change it. Okay, you check and change both in one assembly instruction. Okay, and that is instruction executes atomically. Okay, so you have done multiple things all in one atomic instruction, and you can use that to implement synchronization. Okay, so locks in particular, or semaphores or monitors, they will all use equivalent of test and set instructions on your hardware to implement this functionality. Okay? So what I would encourage you is to go back and review this material. So first you need to understand what synchronization is, because even if you don't understand how to implement it, you are going to use it. Okay, so it's very important to understand it. And you will see when you write your code that there will be more tricky forms of synchronization that is harder to get right. Okay? Then the other thing is the implementation using interrupts and test and run. So just go back, review it. We will come back and we'll show you how to do this in Java and so on and so forth. So don't go away yet. There's still 5 minutes left. So what I want you to do is again do that minute paper. Okay? Want you to tell me what aspect of synchronization you didn't understand, okay, or found it hard to follow, and what aspect of it you liked. Okay, but more importantly, put something that you didn't understand. Do write your name, because you are actually getting some points for doing this extra 1 minute of work. Okay, so if you don't tell us who you are, we can't give you this extra small amount of credit for giving us this feedback. Okay, so just spend, all I want is 2 to 3 lines. Okay, more importantly, what is it that you found it hard to understand? What do you like?